Today's guest, James O'Brien, is the very definition of Radio Marmite, loved and loathed in equal measure for his outspoken views on Brexit, immigration and the cult of English exceptionalism. We started with him giving me an exclusive, which would have been groundbreaking had the show been going out live and not pre-recorded.
Yes, it's true.
When I'm dialing up... So I listen to you most mornings, I would say.
Oh, wow, thank you.
And but I wouldn't say that I'm one of those listeners that is locked into LBC, because to its credit, it is a station that has a broad church of opinions represented.
Yes.
How does that feel? Because there's quite a lot of weight on your shoulders, amongst a few others, actually, having to
steer the
station slightly left of, yes, of Goebbels.
When will this go out? This
well, Dan, my overlord, will know, but probably in the next 3 or 4 weeks, I suspect. Is your answer pertinent to you?
Yes, because in the next hour, I suspect that question would lose a lot of its relevance.
What's happening in the next hour?
I'm not allowed to tell you.
Are you all right? Am I allowed to guess?
Yeah.
But
this is top secret.
And well, people won't know. It'll be like we're having this exciting conversation, and then by the time people get around to listening to it, they'll be like, where have these two been?
Strictly between us,
yeah,
I think Farage is getting his marching orders in the next hour. Or possibly he has decided to resign and spend more time with his prejudices.
More time in Dover shouting at people, and thus breaking lockdown rules. It's amazing. Isn't it how certain people on the political spectrum are allowed to do exactly what they want in regard to those rules? I sort of am speechless because it must. I actually feel quite emotional because it.
Yes. I imagine.
Because my first line of inquiry is going to be, how do you do it? I mean, obviously you hand over from Nick Ferrari, who I'm sure you don't share many political views.
No, but we have.
But
we
nonetheless, he's a fairly open-hearted soul, from what I can imagine. He will at least tolerate another opinion.
And if I needed his help, I think he'd give it to me. So, and also if he wouldn't. I mean, we've got similar backgrounds in newspaper. And although I disagree with him vehemently on some subjects, and sometimes I think he strays into areas that, on reflection, even he would probably rather he hadn't. We've all done that. But Farage and Hopkins are very, very different creatures entirely. They're the worst of the worst, and it's been really tough at some points to justify my continuing presence there. But weirdly, I took a call this very week asking specifically about it, and I think that the Colston issue. I'm not shy or cowardly, but I felt even more emboldened not to defend the station, as it were. I've always let people criticise Farage on my show, and I wish that perhaps it had happened a bit sooner. But
I think there's a difference between having an opinion, having a, as we all do, and having a political bias, and entertaining views on a talk show, and peddling hate, misinformation, and abject lies. And that is my issue. In the same way that it is. I mean, only yesterday in the mother of all parliaments, we had the Labour leader rather respectfully saying, you're lying, you didn't call me in order to set up a collaborative task force, you simply have ignored the question.
Yes, I mean, it is staggering. To be honest, it's the weirdest thing for me with Brexit and Trump in particular, because I thought it was obvious years ago just how far into the mainstream base dishonesty had moved, you know, and there's so many points which you thought would be alarm bells, which weren't. It's more so with Trump, actually, because the Brexit stuff was always, it was always theoretically refutable. So you could bring, for me, the moment, I don't know if this is the base dishonesty, but it's the context in which the dishonesty could triumph. I was interviewing Pascal Lamy, former Director General of the World Trade Organization. This was when I realized I couldn't carry on working for the BBC, and Andrea Leadsom, who you've probably heard of as well.
Oh, I've had a few Twitter moments with her.
She's not a former Director General of the World Trade Organization, just context. And I'm sitting there as a Newsnight presenter. Look, a dream job, but you know, someone that was in the shallow ends of radio phone-in 10 years ago, to end up presenting Newsnight was beyond my wildest dreams. And I do, and even then I remember sitting there and feeling my heart sink because I thought, I can't do this anymore. There's no way I can go on the radio tomorrow and pretend that it's acceptable to balance out a former director general of the World Trade Organization's views about the World Trade Organization with Andrea Leadsom's. It's just absurd. So that false equivalence for me is where it started.
Yeah.
You know, the need to have both sides. And that segued fairly quickly into treating, I believe, lies and truth as if they were two sides of a valid argument. And that's how you end up with Dominic Cummings' bus. But it's also how you end up with Dominic Cummings' lies about his eye test. To me, it's been a fairly easily plotted path. And yet, many people still don't seem to have fully woken up to it, even when you have Keir Starmer standing up in Parliament, as you say, and Boris Johnson claiming a phone call that never occurred in anything like the circumstances that Boris Johnson is claiming. It's very, very odd.
I think when my ears really prick up on your show is when somebody is making a point that's counter to your own and possibly my own sensibility, that comes from a place that we can't inhabit, that comes from outside whatever liberal media elite bubble or place that we happen to live, kind of existence we're inhabiting. And I feel a sense even more that those people are being let down, whether they're white working class or a Bangladeshi second generation immigrant family living nine in a room. Yeah. Those are experiences that you and I can't hope to have and are probably very glad we have never had to have.
Yes.
But those are the people that will be hardest hit by the torrent of lies masquerading as protection. This is the thing, this is the new thing. We've put our arms around you.
Yes.
And those arms just feel to me like they're crushing all the...
It's happened before throughout history, and hopefully we won't end up in as dire straits as other countries have when it's happened. But it is, and it's so hard to articulate that, Sue. That's why I'm really relieved to hear you say it, because I tried to explain yesterday, and it might not have been the best week to do it, that my obsession, if you like, with racism is as much to do with wanting to help the victims of being racist as it is to do with wanting to help the victims of racism, because it helps nobody. It doesn't pay any bills. It doesn't bring any happiness into your life. It doesn't improve your understanding of any issue. It possibly gives you an outlet or an excuse for other unhappinesses. I mean, the line that it lets you blame somebody else for your entire life is one that I used to use a lot, but even that's a little bit cruel, a little bit unkind. But then on the other hand, these are the people that send me death threats and go on Twitter to be vile about my wife and children. So you
get death threats.
I've had a couple of police level warnings that came into the studio via old fashioned letters, untraceable mail. But, and I'm not making light of it, but someone like Diane Abbott gets several a week. So you know that they're not serious up to the point where they are, and you get a Joe Cox scenario or something like that. So my sympathy is sincere and deep, and I wish I'd found a way of helping these people more effectively out of this hatred and darkness. But at the same time, I'm not going to be completely Pollyanna-ish about it. So some of them are just really nasty bastards, and they wish everybody harm. And it's based upon a genuine belief that some accident of birth, some genetic algorithm, makes them more valuable human beings than somebody born somewhere else or born with different coloured skin. And I don't know ultimately how you break through that.
This episode of the podcast is sponsored by Best Fiends. That's friends without the R. Best Fiends is a puzzle game that you can play right on your phone. You progress through different levels, solving challenging puzzles that actually engage your brain in a fun way that everyone can enjoy. I've been playing for the last couple of weeks. I've just made it past level 50. The great thing about Best Fiends is it doesn't take up much of your valuable time, but it is great when you've got a few spare minutes and you've had enough of social media. Whether you're on a break at work or have just got a spare 5 minutes at home, Best Fiends is a great way to keep your brain active and is perfect for when you're social distancing. The game is also visually stimulating with bright colours and cute characters which you collect as you progress through the levels. It updates monthly with new levels and events, so it never gets old and boring. It's a great game to engage your brain with fun puzzles, and you get to collect, did I mention, tons of those cute characters too. Best Fiends is a 5-star rated mobile puzzle game on the Apple App Store and Google Play, and it's had over 100 million
downloads. You can download it for free right now. Just go to the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's Friends without the R. Best Fiends.
What interested me when I read my book, which all of it interests your book rather, not my book. I've never read my book, for God's sake.
Quite right, too.
I want to get involved in that shit. is you talking about your dad.
Yeah.
And talking about how your dad kept the vilest of threats. And these were like yours. They were old fashioned threats. They were mailed through the door or mailed to the office.
Yeah.
And he put them up in the loo.
That's right.
And I wonder if that's where you get your robustness, because for me, I am so porous. And my anxiety, which is only a recent thing due to a slight sort of irritating lump in my brain, is so triggered, which is why I understand rage and anxiety and all those things that lots of people who don't share my values have.
I
sort of think, gosh, that's where you've learnt it from. You know, my dad was very timid and very anxious, and the world sat very heavily on him, and I've inherited that. Whereas your model was, you own the criticism. And you can somehow find a piece with it, which I find very enviable.
It takes a little bit of work, and there are days where it's just exhausting, but it's never hurtful. I derive enormous pride from being despised by Nazis. And I genuinely do. I think it might be, without sounding pompous, I think it's probably the greatest achievement of my working life is to be out there front and centre as a real focal point, not just for the knuckle-dragging Nazis, but for the kind that you know, right, for the spectator as well. All of them hate me. They all despise me. And it's hard to think of any better evidence that I'm doing things right. But I love the thought of Dad being responsible for it. It was Irish stuff for him, for people who haven't read the book yet. It was anti-Irish stuff, which, you know, gave me an insight, oddly, into Islamophobia, because that conflation of everybody with an apostrophe in their surname with the IRA who were killing babies was staggering to me as a child. Dad was on the receiving end of it. The Telegraph, traditionally, a very unionist paper where he used to write. And gave me some empathy into what that must have felt like for everybody Muslim in this country over the last 10 or 15 years. But yes, Dad wasn't a warrior. He wasn't a tough guy. He would never raise his voice in anger. But if it was called for, he was as solid as a rock. There were a couple of things which I write about, I touch on in my new book, my next book. And Dad knocked a teacher out once because a teacher was beating me up on bonfire night at my prep school. And Dad, who was 5'10", quite slight, I'll tell you who he reminds me. Chris Mason at the BBC reminds me of my dad a bit, and both far better journalists than I could ever dream of being. But you know what I mean, quite mild-mannered.
Yeah.
But if you fucked with us, he'd have you. And the same with the abuses and the nastiness that would come into the Daily Telegraph's office. Dad took it as evidence that he was, in some context, as evidence that he was doing good work, and in other contexts that he was on the right side. These people dream of getting under your skin.
Mm.
Because all the while you're living rent-free in their heads. So it's a very odd transaction, a very odd relationship. I'm sorry to hear that you suffer from it, though, because it's very tough, but it's
amazing how one can.
Well, we're all swans, aren't we? Sometimes, I mean,
part of me is. I mean, we're all sort of prismatic creatures, and part of me is incredibly resilient. And then there's another side that just can, things can sit and stew. I found during lockdown, actually, the best remedy for that has been to go out and do. So I've discovered whole new areas of my community. With lockdown, we've been sort of bounded by geography. You know, and knowing who all the rough sleepers are in my neighbourhood, knowing that cheese and Marmite is an acceptable sandwich is for some and not for others. If only there was an advertising campaign that could draw on that. I mean, I have laughed so much, and I have cried so much, and I've and it will be something that I will carry on. You know, that's the only thing that I'm grateful to lockdown for, really.
It's like a recalibration. isn't it, in some areas?
Yeah,
some
parts of life. Because there's no thing as a metropolitan elite area.
No.
And of course, there's a metropolitan area, yes. But you know, in every street, however bourgeois, however fanciful, however you know re-emergent, there are people who have been trafficked. There's some terrible statistics about how close you are to traffic people in urban areas, and there are people who have no homes, no jobs, no immediate future at least, and that's really quelled some of the more toppy sort of fruitless anxiety.
Yes.
But there's also real anxiety about, oh my God, they are going to lock us down. This is my theory now. They're going to lock us down in November, hard lock us down.
Yeah.
So that we can no deal Brexit and not riot.
Yeah.
Well, that's where my brain goes to.
No, I'd hear you. And they'd struggle, I think, to, because the people that want the no deal Brexit have also turned out to be the people most resistant to the lockdown. So these curious little conundrums are, I don't know how comforting they are, but it's as if, you know, if what will be left at the end, it'll just be Boris Johnson standing there alone in his sort of soiled underpants, speaking into a camera while the Statue of Liberty disappears behind him under the stand, and the people, like, you know, we come up like Charlton Heston howling.
Let's get liberty done.
It is, yes, I know. And the other thing is now that even with callers to the radio program, sometimes I'll rein them in. I'm not talking about the mad conspiracy theories like 5G, but the stuff about what they might be up to, what Cummings and Johnson might be up to, how they're going to pull off this astonishing, the next level of this quite magnificent scam that they've undertaken. I've actually stopped being sceptical. I don't think they're planning to lock us down in November to avoid riots as the reality of no deal begins to nibble. But it wouldn't amaze me if conversations like that had actually been had. It's almost liberating, though, to realise just how morally corrupt they are, because then you stop trying to, you know, once you accept. I spent so long thinking that the emperor might actually be wearing a flesh-coloured body stocking. This is one of my favourite analogies, because so many people were still going, this is Brexit, really, more than anything else, but so many people were still going. Even 2 weeks ago, David Davis said the German car industry will be along any minute now to sort everything out. And you'd think, not necessarily that David Davis is an intelligent man, but he's a successful politician. He's,
yes.
And some of these people...
Well, the Venn diagram of intelligence and successful politician is not...
That is the tragedy of our time, actually, isn't it? Because I was looking at Rory Stewart this morning, who's turned out to be right about almost everything and isn't even in Parliament or running for mayor anymore. So you're absolutely right. But I clung to this notion that it can't be as bad as I think it is. It must be, like, not quite as bad as I think it is, because these relatively sensible, stroke successful people are still insisting that it is okay. So this flesh colour, particularly under Theresa May, I'd think, well, she wanted to remain. She must know. But then, no, the emperor is now stark naked, and lots of people are still describing the magnificence of his robes.
I suppose if you put it to me that we were going to be duped en masse, led out of the biggest free trade market in the world, and occupy a pariah position in the world, almost like no other country,
it's unbelievable.
But I would have assumed that this duping would have been done by masterminds.
Yes.
By creative geniuses. So at least you could sit back as you were being duped and go, by God, you're a smart one.
Absolutely.
But no, I've seen the pantomime in the Rose Garden. I know what mediocrity is doing this.
Not astonishing.
To all
I think,
of us.
Do you know, I wonder, going back to the confidence and anxiety question, there's huge insecurity. I went to a posh school, and I know what it's like to build a survival personality. Very, very recently, for a sort of variety of reasons, I didn't realise how much I'd invested in building this suit of armour that was great for getting ahead in certain ways. It's the, you know, the public school, the all boys English top ranked public school. Most lads go through it happily and unharmed and unscathed, but a certain type of lad, the kind of lad who wants to be famous, or who wants to be prime minister, or who wants to be world king, who wants to be on stage all the time, you know, the show-offs. We, I think, build these personalities that are false, and they come with epic insecurity. And I wonder whether the success of Cummings is just based upon his sort of pathological self-belief. And because if you look at the evidence, there's very little there to suggest that he's got much going on. But the way he clearly talks to people who've got intellectual insecurities, like Boris Johnson or Dominic Raab, or I'd hope Priti Patel would have intellectual insecurities, but I'm not sure she's bright enough to realise how unintelligent.
I'm sorry you feel that is the case.
Well, I'm sorry if you feel that is the case. I think Cummings gets away with it by, you want a better word than bluster, but it's, as you point out, it's certainly nothing close to genius. Even diabolical genius would be better than bluster.
Yeah. Right?
And it's the same with Steve Bannon. Everyone fakes Steve Bannon as some sort of super brain. All they did was racist lies. All they did to get Trump in was racist lies about Mexicans, about immigrants, about Muslims. All they did to get Brexit over the line was essentially racist lies with a little bit of lie about the NHS thrown in. And so, you know, it is dispiriting to think that half of the country, half of both countries, fell for an invitation to whack themselves over the head with the frying pan in return for being allowed to be publicly racist again. And look where it's got us this week, you know, in the Edward Colston context. Mm-hmm. It was always going to lead to something like this because the truth doesn't go away. And nobody who voted for Brexit is going to have their life improved. Nobody, even if they wanted foreign people deported, and it happened, it wouldn't improve their life. This whole message that Cummings somehow is credited with having created a USS Enterprise of spin, it's really not. It's just a baseball bat, isn't it? It's the oldest baseball bat of all, and they just go around whacking people with it. But I think Johnson looks at him and thinks, well, he really believes.
Yes.
Well, that's what we need, someone, because I haven't got a clue. There was an exchange in the Sunday Times when Robert said, well, they just laid out the plan for the next stage of lockdown. And Johnson apparently looked around the table and said, well, who's in charge of implementing this then? Who's in charge of implementing this? And Tim Shipman wrote this, and he will know because his contacts are impeccable. And turns to Mark Sedwill, the cabinet secretary, is it you? Is it you, Robert? Is it? And Sedwill just sort of goes, no, Prime Minister, I think this is part of your brief. And you know that that's too plausible not to be true.
Stitch Fix is an online personal styling service for men and women, where an expert stylist picks clothes just for you based on your taste, size, and price preferences. And then they just deliver those clothes straight to your door. Perfect if you want to discover something new and avoid queues at the newly opened shops. How does it work? Well, it's easy and fun. You fill out a style profile about your clothing preferences, including how much you'd like to pay, on their simple-to-use website. And then it's over to your stylist, who will hand-select and send to you 5 items of clothing and accessories in your preferred fit and style. Try them at home and then decide which ones you want to buy. You just pay for what you keep and send the rest back with free returns. There's a charge of just £10 for your stylist's time, which is redeemable against anything that you decide to keep. I found Stitch Fix a great way to discover brands and styles I never would usually have picked for myself. Stitch Fix has over 100 men and women's brands, including well-known names, more niche emerging designers, and their own exclusive in-house brands that you won't find anywhere else. And you don't have to subscribe. Just order a one-off delivery whenever you like, or set up a regular delivery if that's what you want. Not only will your stylist select items that suit you, but they'll give you ideas on how to wear the items that are sent. Get started with Stitch Fix today and support our podcast by going to stitchfix.co.uk/our in capitals right now. That's stitchfix.co.uk/our.
I started therapy myself a few years ago, and almost by the second or third session, I'd find myself looking at people in my industry, and oddly, I'd be thinking, my God, you would be so, I could help you now. I've only had 3 sessions. And then, of course, the other bit, which was weird, and I'm writing about this at the moment, this very afternoon, is you start wondering, well, if I actually do take my suit of armor off, if I actually do heal my inner child, will I be, I used to say to my therapist, I don't want you to therapize me out of a career, you know, at least let me hang in there till the kids leave home. And there is, clearly, you know, Piers Morgan's been on a very interesting journey lately, but he has publicly found the ability to not quite atone yet or repent, but to change his mind in public. And think how rare that is now, how completely rare that is.
And he has a righteous fury that's very,
yes, Yes.
Compelling, and it's no longer directed against individuals, which, you know, it's always sat very, very uncomfortably when he's targeted Meghan Markle and there's been a sort of vicious.
Yeah.
And you know, and you know, I've taken pot shots at peers in my line of work, and he has responded by very amply crucifying me on his program. But I would happily, you know, look him in the eye and say thank you to him for using his platform to
do the stuff he's done,
to do extraordinary work in highlighting the absence of PPE, calling the government to account, constantly railing against the piss poor kind of handling of this crisis and the resultant deaths. I mean, you in the same way that he's changed, you know, we also have to change and go fair play, you know.
Yes, I think you're right. I see. I block furiously on Twitter, and I never blocked him. And it was odd because usually I block people if they're blue ticks and mildly famous and they're coming after someone who's got five times as many followers. They're just desperately hoping that you'll have a fight with them, or because it draws more attention to them, or you know, every couple of years another radio presenter pops up on another station and tries to manufacture some sort of feud with me. And it will sound very arrogant, but I generally don't even know who they are, let alone why I'd want to get into a feud with someone whose audience is a tenth of the size of mine. But Piers used to do it from a position of strength, and he'd tweet really nasty stuff at me with 7.5 million Twitter followers. So my usual, I'll just block him, he's attention seeking, he's trying to ride my coattails, which I concede is a bit arrogant, but it just doesn't apply to him. So I never blocked him. And sometimes I'd get involved and I'd put my phone down and I'd be all shaky inside and I'd be like, why are you doing it again? And more times, he'd probably argue, more times than not, I'd get the better of him. And even when you got the better of him, there's that, oh, why did you rise to the bait? But I think you've just hit on why, because I always sensed somewhere that it was worth it. That there was a, I don't think he'll enjoy this characterization, but because it sounds so patronizing, but you just thought that he's not in his trench in the way that some of the other people I've had problems with over the years are. I just thought he is movable, and he is. You see his interaction with Gary Lineker, who for me is one of the great forces for good, and you'd know. And I spoke to Gary about this, and I'd say, why do you bother? And he'd go, because Piers is all right. And I'd go, really? I don't know him well. Our paths cross very rarely, because generationally we're never in the same place at the same time. And I'd go, really, is he? And he'd go, no, he really is. And the analogy I always use is that we've all got toolboxes. And tabloid journalism in particular gives you two or three blunt instruments, and you can rule the world of tabloid journalism with two or three blunt instruments. Yeah. And I've got people I like, people I have worked with over the years who haven't got any other tools in their box. And I think the point about Piers was that he was always open to the idea of putting new tools in his box. And that's why he felt different on social media from the people trying to start fights for completely specious reasons.
Something touched a place that I've not seen, which yes. Obviously would have always been there. It's just, you know, we only know people through their public,
exactly. Their
public face. And, you know, it's something, the NHS is so close to my heart. It's such a passion project to make sure it doesn't fail, it isn't underfunded, it isn't discarded or privatised. That, you know, when somebody like him really goes in for the charge, you just... Yeah. You put aside everything else and go,
yes,
thank you, actually, because your reach is so much greater than I do what I can in my way.
Sure. But he mobilizes forces that most of us can't.
And has the robustness to deal. Well, at least, again, I assume he has the robustness to deal with those who...
Yeah, I've got him on my interview schedule, actually. And I'm really looking forward to trying to get under the bonnet a bit on that kind of stuff.
Yeah, well, I'd be interested to you most certainly draw upon the fact that even people that he'd have sort of would assume have nothing in common with, such as myself, are kind of, yeah, you know, it's... You have to sort of say good for you, because it's
you're right.
His own petty sphere.
And changing your mind in the public space is my next big project. I think that's a huge thing. You have to help people. It's like we began this conversation talking about people who are curdled and crippled by what's being poured into their ears. And we failed in the context of Brexit to create a space in which people could say, oh, God, I feel a bit silly. I mean, I created a space of sorts, but it was a tiny contribution to the bigger picture and ultimately wholly inadequate. You know, the Remain March, the big thing in Parliament Square. We never successfully found a way of letting people, and this of course sounds condescending because I'm talking about other people's mistakes rather than my own, but we have to let people be wrong without that being the only thing that anybody ever mentions again or talks about. And you know, he's a brilliant example of that, actually.
No one put their arms around people. It's interesting now that's been co-opted, that phrase, by yes, Boris. But nobody from Remain did that. Whether it was embracing people by talking about the positive benefits over hundreds of years of immigration, or of the Objective One schemes that pumped money into, you know, disenfranchised areas of the UK. No one did that. There was an arrogant assumption, and I think the Brexit has meant hopefully the end of arrogant assumptions. And
to fight for it if it's valuable. You have to fight for it because, you know, otherwise someone will try to take it away.
But in a post-truth world, I think I don't think that even making the case for anything has sway. Sadly, I think it's going to be communities over time looking at what's happened and realising that with 10 plus years of Tory rule, with, you know, possibly a hard no deal Brexit coming, that their circumstances, their reduced circumstances, and I hope I'm wrong, can only be attributed and laid at those people's feet.
The next battle is not to let new scapegoats be put in place where Brussels and uncontrolled immigration, whatever that means, where uncontrolled immigration and Brussels were, new scapegoats will pop up. And I think the next battle, certainly what keeps me honest, is the thought that we'll have to still keep pointing out, no, it's not the fault of, what are we going to do? Go back to single mothers? Are we going to go back to gay people? Are we going to
will go back to gay. A mate of mine who knows stuff just said, you wait and see, within the next few years there'll be redrafting a version of Section 28.
Nothing would shock me at the moment, because they have to keep throwing red meat to these poor souls who have really nothing in their lives except anger and fear, and they never know what they're angry about. But again, I need to find a new way of talking about this, because I sound condescending and patronising and even paternalistic when I say this stuff. My defence is I talk to them every day. I know what they're like, these people, and they can't tell you why they're angry, which is like for someone like Farage to come along and say, see that immigrant over there, he's trying to steal your job, he is, and he's also here to take all the benefits and send them home, and also he'll probably steal your wife, and also, you know, why have we got Polish signs up in the shops on our street? It's so easy to foment these feelings that it will be easy, as your friend has said, to move them on to some of the more, what would you say, the traditional targets of the country?
Yes. I'd like to think so, yes. I'd like to think. You know, your newfangled bigotry. I mean,
good old fashioned hate.
School, yeah. Exactly right. Led by a man who, for me, just seeing, you know, LGBTQ History Month, being ushered in by a man who talked of sort of tank top wearing bum boys, and then straight after that, you know, Black History Month, you know, by the guy who talked about pickaninnies and watermelon smiles, and it's just so shocking.
It's such an overused phrase. I wish I'd never mentioned Orwell until this year, because you feel like you've used up all the Orwell in your tank, and then you see all the nut jobs on the other side, the ones who this week suddenly found themselves defending slavery. You sort of wonder, like, at what point do you go, hang on a minute, it's like that Mitchell and Webb sketch that everybody shared. So, hang on, are we the baddies? What are you doing this week, Mum? Well, I'm writing 1,000 words on why we shouldn't take down statues of slave traders. So, pardon? You're doing. I'm just knocking out a quick column on why we shouldn't take down statues of what? Slave traders. And what? How can there not be a little alarm in your head at that point? You know, even if you still rabidly despise Brussels, even if you've still got some, you know, issues. You're doing what? But anyway, here we
are. That's just the fault of it's not a left-right thing, it's a fault of successive post-war governments to really change anything for people who have little.
Yes, you know? I think the 97 to 2000, the two Labour governments or the two Labour leaders probably did a little bit more than we realised at the time. Blair gets completely banjaxed by Iraq, but yes, the work that we've done within education and child poverty. I mean, I look at Gordon Brown, and for me, he's very emblematic of what you've just described. He wasn't a perfect politician or a perfect man. That's the point, isn't it? Nobody is. But if you could imagine Gordon Brown having been in charge of coronavirus response, you know he wouldn't have slept. You know he'd be there with matchsticks holding his eyes open, taking one more bit of advice from one more scientist. And you know that he would have felt the weight of every single death, whether he kept it down to Angela Merkel's scale levels or whether he ended up unwittingly presiding over Boris Johnson's scale levels. You just know that they would have cared. And so, yes, successive governments have failed to fix things that needed to be fixed. But for me, that always comes back to the newspapers. Even I, at the time, was buying into some of the Gordon Brown stuff and thinking, oh, he's this and he's that, and he sold the gold. And it's just so lazy, so two-dimensional. And it's led us, I think, to where we are now, where people are waving their flag or their scarf. They don't care what happens on the pitch. They just care about what team the person that's done it is on. So what the, you know, if you watch football, you can criticize your own team, but if your defender scythes down an attacker in the box, like breaks his leg in eight places, you're on your feet screaming, "That wasn't a foul, ref, that wasn't a foul at all." And the bloke, you know, he's having his leg amputated in the center circle. And that's what politics has become. And it doesn't divide on left, right lines. It's someone who was very impressed by Corbyn and Johnson at the last election, people didn't know how to process it. They presumed that if you thought Boris Johnson was a wrong and you must be pro-Corbyn, and if you thought Corbyn was a waste of space, you must have been pro-Johnson. And that's my hope for the future, is that there's actually many, many more of us here now. We're still split by Leave Remain, but an awful lot of people who voted to leave the European Union must be looking at Boris Johnson and thinking, what the flip is that about? So that has to be just the congregation in the middle has to be the next stage.
I don't even think about Leave Remain anymore, in a way. I think I've burnt that out my
system. Leavers do.
Because
it's over. It's it. You know, it's not even, we don't even have any influence over damage limitation now. It's all in the lap of the gods, but they're still fighting these wars.
You get these confusing statements like you're a member of a left Waffe. And yeah. I try and respond going, well, you're part of the right Stag. And I think, no, I'm not going to do that. It's beneath me. It's terrible.
That's a pun. And they're all right wing. I mean, again, I don't.
You're accusing me of being the airborne division, a left wing airborne division of a fascist sort of wannabe super state. I don't understand what you mean.
Go and look three, four tweets into their timeline, and they are far right sympathizers, almost like they don't realize what the Second World War was about. Some of the people seem to have more sympathies with the Nazis than they do with the Allies, and yet here we are.
My thing at the moment is I just want to be, it sounds banal, but I do think sort of niceness is so, it's decried, but it's such a valuable tool. I don't have to really block people on Twitter. I very rarely have arguments. Sometimes if I've said something maybe on the last leg or a platform in which I'm allowed to be more political, I might have a few. And one guy I remember said, I hope your family get cancer. And I sort of took a beat and I was just very sort of, you know, as you describe that moment, that sort of where all you're too alive.
It's fight or flight, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Your limbic system is just off the chart. And I just thought, well, I'm going to engage. And I just said sort of very sort of calmly, no catching. And I said, well, that's difficult to hear because my dad, who I loved very much, died of cancer. And I ended up having this extraordinary conversation with this guy who then said, yeah, my mum died of it. I went, I'm really sorry to hear that. He said, yeah, it's awful, isn't it? I said, yeah. I thought, at this point, I could say, so why would you wish that on?
Yes, yeah.
I just thought, no. And then I ended up just, he said, well, take care of yourself. And that's how it ended. I can't judge him. I mean, I wouldn't wish cancer on anybody. No, but I have felt fury.
Yes.
And I have felt it because in my life I've had some bad things happen, no more, no less than anyone else. And they have, in their own way, traumatised me. And until I got help, my response was the fear to aggression response.
Yes, that's right. Same here.
Fuck you. Yeah. And then you get past that. And I just, we're all just trying
if you're to lucky, cope. If you're lucky, you get past it. And
yeah.
That's what I meant earlier when I said, you know, the danger of being therapized out. You're not a professional combatant, you know.
No, I couldn't be. I would be.
Probably could have been if you hadn't managed to break out of that fight or flight role, I was beating people up on the radio for a living for years. It made me famous, but I'm not that person anymore, and largely because of the reasons you've just described.
You can still be a combatant, but yes, you exactly. don't feel it.
You don't have to beat them up.
No, there's that critical distance that you can apply, yes. which I'm still working on.
In the context of social, I always think of the woman who killed herself after she was outed as one of the Madeleine McCann trolls when Sky News tracked her down to her house and put her name out there. I always, even the vilest stuff on there, I always think, if they put your name on this, you might, you know, so that keeps me on the straight and narrow as well. You know, people do weird things.
Well,
weird
if me with my lucky, luxurious, affluent, easy life.
Yes.
can be susceptible to fear and anxiety.
Yes, exactly.
Then I have to accept
and rage.
At the very least.
Yes. If you had a lot less.
Most other people, yes, if you had a lot less, you will also feel that. And you're absolutely right. You kind of think, where's that come from? I know where my upset comes from. I'm not going to try and invest too heavily in where I think yours might come from, but at the same time I'm going to acknowledge it's there. And so if we can't bother friends, let's at least have a degree of respect. And I think for me, traveling really helped. You know, I came from a family where, you know, we didn't really go anywhere. We didn't travel a lot, and I didn't see an avocado till I was 22. I don't know why I say that, but it felt like a massive watershed moment. I didn't get into a black cab till I was 24, 25.
I got bullied at public school for not knowing what an anchovy was.
Oh, my God. Well, I hope they were given a damn good sort of dressing down.
Damn good dressing, yes. Well, I say bully.
There would have been some sort of anchovy ritual. Yeah. Probably involving some excellence. I wanted to, I mean, this may seem like a rather sort of blunt line of inquiry, but I'm right in thinking you're adopted. Is that right?
Yes, yes.
So I know lots of people who are adopted, and the hallmark for me of their lives is either they have taken sort of two paths. They either are people who pursue almost relentlessly at their own cost truth and cannot stand shadow, or they have followed in the tradition of secrecy and are almost totally unknowable.
Oh.
And I wonder, because it seems to me that you do go into battle for truth. Often people say, oh, you're left, this and that. But actually, you do want to find out the truth,
yes.
even if it cuts across your natural party inclinations.
Yes, of course. Of course. I've never linked it to adoption. I mean, Mum is one of those people who, I don't even know if she overshares. When I was a teenager, I thought she overshared. But but I think we probably all do. Mum's the kind of person who takes her 2 hours to get around Sainsbury because she knows everybody in Kidderminster, and she has to stop for a chat with everyone. So, I mean, having everything about myself out in the open always seemed the most safe way of living. You know, if I was ashamed of being adopted and I kept it secret, then it's a weapon with which someone can hurt me. You know, it's the same with our children being born with fertility treatment. And I don't see, I wrote an article about it for the Daily Mail of all places, because I didn't see what I was supposed to be ashamed of or embarrassed about. You know, it was my condition that meant we needed medical intervention, but it didn't make me feel less of a sex god. Or less masculine or anything like that, and yet people think that so I share information like that, and then people try to use it to hurt me as if you've discovered a secret about me because I told you. So I got that from Mum. The more that is out in the open and the more that is true, the safer you are.
How can a third party hurt a couple going through IVF more than the vicissitudes of IVF itself?
Oh, it's unthinkable. But I still get, my oldest is 14 now. So that article is 14 years old and it's still on the Daily Mail website. And I still get people contacting me about that. Most recently, a woman in Australia just saying, I wanted to say thank you. I found your email address. It came in via the radio station because my husband and I have finally had a conversation after I showed him your article, because it was entirely from the male point of view. About, you know, it's supposed to feel like this and it's supposed to feel like that. And just getting it out there felt to me like power, you know, it was knowledge, it was truth. And it was, so that would be the direction of traffic coming out of me. In terms of what matters to me, I don't think you can make any decisions, really, like I just said about Gordon Brown, until you've got as much information as possible in front of you. And so much effort is put into keeping people in the dark. You know, that great line from Anirin Bevan about the wealth using its power to persuade Labour to vote in the interests of wealth. I wasn't political as a younger man. I wasn't really political until I got to LBC, actually. I was a showbiz journalist. And as I spoke to people, and as I saw the damage that had been done, the firefighters dispute was huge for me, because people I liked from my old life were writing columns about how firefighters were all chancers and they all had 8 jobs and they all lived in Ibiza. And I would take the calls from the punters, you see, and I would think to myself, but if your house catches fire, they're going to run into your house and rescue your children. Why are you ringing me up to slag them off and say they shouldn't be trusted? That was the firefighter. Since then, of course, it's moved on to, I mean, teachers are always there, but it moved on to doctors.
Doctors, yeah.
Doctors. So I sit there, and this is really what radicalised me or politicised me. I would be talking to people who had been successfully persuaded to hate on doctors and on firefighters and on teachers. And I'd think, I'm taking my little girl to school, I'm handing her over to somebody who I don't know that well, but I am trusting them with her life today, not just her education, but, you know, right at the extremities, I'm trusting them with her life. And they then turn to me and say, do you trust me enough to believe me when I tell you that we need your help, that our employers, this government, are riding roughshod over our terms and conditions? Or the firefighters would say that they're changing the job that we signed up for, and we wouldn't have signed up for it, some of us, if it had been what they're trying to turn it. And that bond of trust seems to me to be all about truth. And the more truth you get out there, the more trust we will have in the people that most deserve it. But yeah, politically, the firefighters, the teachers and the doctors, and to a lesser extent, the nurses, when I saw people I liked and people I used to admire, and I saw and heard them going after these sections of society, that's when everything shifted for me. And I very pompously began to think of my working life as having some sort of purpose.
Well, it's about taking the tribalism out, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's about saying, oh, because they're unionised. And let's face it, that's what it's about.
That's what it always comes
to. Always about trades union.
Yes.
Take that out. Take that sort of blunt instrument out. You're talking about, as you say, men and women who put themselves in danger to save your family, your possessions, your home, for so little money they are often forced to take on secondary jobs.
Incredible.
And the discussion really should be is how can we better treat and better pay our fire workers and our public, all our key workers?
Yes. And then the other breakthrough point for me was when talking about pensions, probably with one of these public sector industrial disputes, and it was about pensions. And I take calls from people who say, well, my pension got taken away, or I haven't got a pension, and my pension is rubbish. And I used to do the usual TV shows, the paper reviews and the panels. And part of the reason I stopped was because of what you just described, the ludicrous binary tribal nature of it all. And I remember one of them saying, well, my pension's rubbish and I don't, or we don't get a pension, so why should they get a pension? And I thought, if you got mugged yesterday, would you wake up today saying, I'm not going to be happy until everybody's been mugged? How does the fact that they screwed you over on your pension rights in the private sector somehow inflame you with righteous indignation at the idea of some people in the public sector still having them? And that's where it's a flattering way that you put it, but that's where the quest for truth comes from. Just the sure belief, the simple belief, the conviction and the faith that most people will do the right thing when they've got the right information. And it's the effort that's put into giving them the wrong information that probably animates me most, actually.
Where do you think, I mean, you and I are sort of people who spend quite a lot of time sort of raging, dying of a light, but, you know, at this precise moment in history where we statues are quite rightly being pulled down, where they provide an almost constant reminder to Black and Asian minority groups that Britain doesn't care about them and what was done to them. At that moment, in this moment in history where we're doing that, it's a chance to reimagine. what sort of things would you like to put in place? What would you like to see happen? Bearing in mind that our great leaders haven't given us the vision of, sure. of Brexit, what is your vision of the next 5 years? What's the best thing that could possibly happen out of this mess?
The best thing is community. The best thing is taking off these scarves that are tied so tightly around our necks that they've cut off the flow of oxygen to our brains. And the way, unfortunately, the way you do that is to recognise the inequality. And to really double down on that line about if all you've ever known is privilege, then equality does feel like persecution. It can feel like oppression. So I think those of us on the right side, the lucky side of the road, need to be very, very honest about it and treat people as if they are bright and concerned and caring, because the people who treat them as if they are stupid and callous and cruel have generally got all the best tunes. They also generally have, today's news notwithstanding, they generally have the bigger platforms, and they generally have the clickability and that for me would be the biggest breakthrough. If we could somehow persuade people whose safety and happiness animate our work. I don't talk about racism just to protect victims of racism. As I said earlier, I talk about racism because it's a cage, it's a straitjacket of rage, and I want to help them out of that. So if they could just pause and see that all the people they've been persuaded to hate, all the left waffer, and some of the people on the left are holier than thou and worthy and hypocritical and stupid to varying degrees, we probably all are, but the people who are motivated by trying to make society better for everybody, if you could just persuade more people that was what you were trying to do, then I think everything would get better. And the best way to do that is to recognize the imbalances. You know, a country in which Jacob Rees-Mogg can end up leader of the House of Commons and preside over that ludicrous sub-Alton Towers, sub-IKEA mess in the streets outside last week, that's just not right. Because if he'd been born, I often think if I hadn't been adopted, I'd have been raised by a teenage mum, a single teenage mum in rural Catholic Ireland, God knows what would have happened to me, but I doubt it would have been pretty. And I always have that duality going on. And we seem at the moment to be ruled, and we've really given the whip hand to people that never acknowledge the luck in their life. They never think that it's serendipitous. You know, you see Donald Trump's son, who was, the Americans always say born on third base, and he thinks he scored a triple. You see Dominic Cummings, his father-in-law, talking about strong genes. The people born with these immense amounts of luck and privilege. And relatively speaking, I don't have much. We didn't go on holiday when we were kids so that dad and mum could send me and my sister to private schools. There's no silver spoon. My dad grew up above a pub in Leeds. But I'm still incredibly privileged compared to most people and incredibly lucky. And I don't understand why people with more privilege and more luck and more money and more inheritance and more wealth than me have such a massive problem admitting it. It just seems if we all admitted it, then the people with the least would probably feel a little less enraged, and the people with the most would probably do a bit more sharing. I don't know. I'm probably being a snowflake.
God damn you. I think for me, I sort of feel you're absolutely right. Community is the way to start. Part of me would introduce people sort of say, well, what would you do if you were leading the show, which would never happen because politics is too stressful for me. But yeah. I would remove, as I said many times, all student fees, but you'd have to do a year or 6 months, actually. 6 months you can travel, do what you want, but 6 months you'd have to be in the community working with old people or working.
Now would be a great time to do it. Now
it'd
would
be fantastic.
John Ashton has been writing about it.
Yeah, he's reset
the school year to January and use the gap to introduce some form of national youth service.
And have a pen pal kind of system where you will take kids from Eton and you will say, okay, you're going to we have twinned you with a fabulous Muslim family in Bradford, and you're going to spend a week with them, and they'll come and spend a week with you.
Yes.
And you're going to learn, but also hopefully you'll be friends, and you'll be shocked, and you'll be driven out of your prejudices on both sides. And because if you can't rely on the natural instincts of human beings to be good, then a little bit of civic forcing would have to happen.
Do you know, I think probably the most formative experience of my youth was doing youth theatre in Manchester with a lot of kids there who were on council grants to be there. You know, they've been given this back in 1988, and that, and I wasn't, I don't think I was in danger of becoming a sort of sub Brideshead revisited cliche, but like a lot of middle class kids, I felt insecure about class. So I would pretend, or I would adopt like Ian Duncan Smith or someone like that, you know, I'd pretend to be much posher than I actually was. And then I went to youth theatre and I met all of these people from so many different backgrounds. And a lot of them found me fascinating for exactly the reasons that you describe. And by the end of 6 weeks, you suddenly realise, actually, we're all the same. There aren't any differences at all. I'm going back to public school. You're going back to what was later called a bog standard comprehensive. You're going somewhere in between. And yet here we all are, dancing to the same tune, loving the same experience, and subscribing to the same schools. It was lovely, actually.
I think the most instructive thing that ever happened to me, that was the thing that sort of made me realise my great privilege and try and, yes, just kick me up the arse, is that I went to Vietnam and I spent a week with people working in the rice paddies, and I was probably managed 20 minutes a day in the boiling heat up to my knees in mud. Well, this woman worked and worked and worked, and they just laughed at me. And I was, you know, this slightly sort of podgy, nerdy, idiotic woman with no transferable skills. And one night we got very, very drunk. I was staying on their table, so I rigged up a mosquito net.
Yeah.
Had these wonderful nights as the sun set in the middle of nowhere place. And I said to the husband, I said, oh, what would you most like in the world? And he was talking about this tractor. He wanted a big tractor. And then I said to the wife, who'd been so scathing, quite rightfully scathing about me since I arrived, and I said, what do you most want? And I didn't even finish the sentence. Yeah. And she just went, I want to be you.
Oh, boy.
I thought, yes, of course. Everything just shattered then, because I think I'd written her response. And it was so, in retrospect, I would be too horrified and appalled to tell you what I thought she might have come out with. But some little, you know, cute thing about, oh, I just, you know, my own rice paddy. Oh, no, she looks at me with my surfeit, you know, my fat, full belly and my perfect white skin masked with sunscreen. And just thought, I want it. And from that moment on, I thought, oh, God, you get it. I'll do what I can. You know, and everyone needs a moment like that. And I didn't learn that until very late. So I'm not trying to virtue signal or, you know.
No, I know.
Apocalyptically late.
And to tie it in with everything else we've talked about, telling people who feel like they've got nothing, but in the great scheme of things, they've got close to everything, is really, really hard to do. It's so much easier to tell them that what little they've got is under threat from them over there. But actually, everybody who lives in the United Kingdom, this is... Obviously, you know, we've got huge, huge problems, but socioeconomically, how do you tell someone that the reason people want to come here is because things are really, really shit? That's it. I mean, they want to come here to benefit from what you benefit from, not to steal anything from you. Mm. But I took a call from a Polish woman today who's obviously had a tough time of it with Brexit and now coronavirus. And she was just saying, I came to Britain from Poland because I wanted a better life, but I also thought it would be a better country. I thought it would be better run. Poland has had all sorts of problems over the years. It emerges from communism, the years of communism. And sometimes it takes an outsider, doesn't it, to make you see what's in front of you. And she just said, I don't understand how I've ended up being governed by these people. Because in Poland, they're all coming out. There's only 5,000 dead or something, and they're all coming out of lockdown. How have we ended up with all these jewels and all these riches and all these magnificence that people who are routinely told that they hate this country value and recognise and love? And we've just ignored it all and thrown it all away.
How come we're governed by the only right-wingers who can't make the trains run on time? That was the whole
privatisation. That's privatisation. Yeah.
don't get me started. Listen, I thank you so much for spending an hour now. I really appreciate it, James.
That was lovely. Thank you.
Big thanks to James, and his podcast Full Disclosure is available now from wherever you get your podcasts. As always, all the music in this episode was from Waiting for Smith. You can find him on social media, and why not listen to more of his music on Spotify.
Yes, it's true. When I'm down and I'm blue, all I do is stare at the view. I'll be heading east to find my peace, where the desert feasts.